Coming up on Broadway Radios this week on Broadway, we talk with Jeff Bowen from Title of Show and Now Hear This, and about his upcoming CD and projects over in London. Please stay with us and listen.
What if this dialogue were set to music? What if what we're saying could be said in a song?
Hey, that's not a bad idea. Perhaps we could use it. Music in a musical, how can we go wrong?
We could ask significant questions. We could get important points across, like, are we writing for art? And is art a springboard for fame?
And will fame get folks to trust us?
But will they trust us if it's just us, me and you? Two nobodies in New York.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Videos, this week on Broadway for Sunday, December 23rd, 2012. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this afternoon, we have Michael Portantier. Peter is traveling to see family for the holidays, so we're going to give him a break. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at the Sondheim Review. He also writes for Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at Broadway Stars and Follow Spot Photo, as well as other places around the internet. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
With us this morning, we have a special guest, Jeff Bowen, who we know from many different projects. I know him from different projects, but we know him from Now Hear This, which is an off-Broadway show that was at the Vineyard this previous spring. And we also know him from the Broadway show Title of Show, where he was not only, correct me if I'm wrong here, Jeff, you wrote music and lyrics, and then you also played Jeff.
It was a challenging role to play Jeff. Actually, it is challenging, but
it's a big stretch, isn't it?
It was a character, you know. It was a character based on me, but it was indeed a character.
Excellent. And I know Jeff as Fern's father in a children's theater production of Charlotte's Web that he and I did. Jeff was reminding me that it was 20 years ago, but I think it was really only 3 years ago.
We've been on the planet that long to say that we did theater together 20 years ago, James.
It was Seaside Music Theater. We did Summer Stock at 1992 at Seaside Music Theater with Lester Malaysia and everybody else that was there. That was It's a wonderful summer. What did we do? We did Evita, Merry Widow,
Of the Ice Sing, and the Copet Yes and Phantom.
Oh, the Copet Yes and Phantom.
Oh, wow.
That's right. And we did. What was the other? We did Emperor's New Clothes, didn't we?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. So, Jeff, thank you for getting up on a Sunday morning and chatting with us.
Absolutely.
Have a question. When you do the Emperor's New Clothes in children's theater, is anybody naked?
It wasn't that type of thing. It was family theater, you know?
We were naked under our clothes.
Oh, okay.
The Emperor and had a suit, a beige bodysuit.
Oh, that's right. You wore that bodysuit. Oh, my God, James. That's hysterical.
So, and oh, my God, you know, I'm pretty sure the 200 or 300 children that we
just haunted that morning.
That is the magical piece in their life. So I take credit for that, you know.
Good work.
So anyway, on to see how we progress from Summer Stock Theater and Children's Theater to Broadway, Jeff.
There's no difference. It's just geography, if I've learned one thing.
It's just geography and budget?
That's it.
Yes, budget, yeah.
Here. As you heard, we had some problems with Jeff's audio, so we swapped him over to a phone line. So if you notice a difference in the quality, that's what's happening. Thanks. We're back to Jeff now. So, Jeff, tell me, how did the Now Hear This evolve? Did it happen during Title of Show or after Title of Show? Or what was this story behind it?
Susan Blackwell, who was in Title of Show, had an idea to sort of keep the engine running. Right about the time we were finishing Title of Show on Broadway in 08, and she wanted to explore a piece that would essentially include these things we were doing at the time. We were doing a lot of these one-off appearances where we were hosting things like the Drama Desk Awards or the Actors Fund Gala, the Vineyard Theaters, gala, things like that, where we were writing these very elaborate original pieces that sort of married songs and stories. And she liked that format and wanted to explore doing an original piece using that idea of sort of song stories. And over the years, over a couple of years, she and Hunter developed it, and then I came on board to write original music and lyrics for it. And the Vineyard picked it up and was very interested in it, and we developed it with them. And then we did a lab production of it in 2011, just for a couple of weeks of developing, spent another year working on it, and then we did it off-Broadway spring into summer. And it's a musical that sort of explores the challenges of being present in your life and how the rewards that can come from acknowledging who you are, where you are, and what it is you're doing in your life, and be fulfilled and be present for it. And we did it sort of autobiographically, although we call it autobiofictionography because not all of it's true. there's definitely a theatrical element to it, so it's not all just stand-up bio on stage.
So you had this was your second experience at the Vineyard, is that correct?
My second.
And
working with the Vineyard. Mm-hmm.
And great things came out of the first stint with them. So, and then you went on to decide to make a cast recording, which the cast recording business is very tenuous, especially for an off-Broadway show to try and make that money back. I mean, most Broadway shows create cast recordings as a marketing tool more than as a money-making venture. So you tried something very interesting here. You launched a Kickstarter campaign. How did that go?
It went really well. We had we realized one thing that was very beneficial when we were doing Title of Show. Kevin McCollum, who produced Title of Show off-Broadway and on-Broadway, between the time we were doing the not-for-profit run at the Vineyard and moving into a profit run, he said, let's get this recorded so we have essentially a marketing tool for the show, but not only that, a tool for investors. So if there were more potential people who wanted to come on board, there was this actual physical thing that they could hold in their hands and have a window into the show. So it was kind of a really important marketing tool because we had it then before we got to Broadway. It's actually a recording of the off-Broadway production. And it was essential. And so I sort of learned from that that if, our long-term goals would now hear this, though it may not be Broadway, we certainly want other people to do it, and we want it to get licensed, and we want it to be out in the world. So a way to do that is to have some sort of physical presence of its existence while it's not being performed. And a cast album is a great way to have that. So I came up with the idea to approach Kickstarter, and we had worked with Ghostlight Records on the Title of Show cast album, and I talked to Kurt Deutsch, who's the president there, and he was very interested. They came to see Now Hear This, and they liked the show, and Joel Moss, who mixed the Title of Show album, also came to see the show, and I spoke to them about, are you guys interested in this? Here's the deal. We're going to try to see if we can raise the funds through Kickstarter, since there was no commercial producer on board for Now Hear This, and the Vineyard, the Vineyard's a not-for-profit. They can't shell out $90,000 to do a cast album. It's not really what they do either. So we all got together and said, let's see if we can make this happen on Kickstarter. And it did. It was successful, and we were beside ourselves and very happy.
And now we have the fruition of it is that just a few days ago was the official release, the December 18th, both the digital and CD formats of the album were released. And were you really more in the role of a producer this time than you were on the on Title of Show, or how did that work out?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was very much, this has been my baby for the past 6 months. I've worked my arse off on it. And it's been great. It's been really rewarding. I've learned so much, but I really was sort of producing this with the help of a lot of people, but really trying to man it and make it happen and make it a reality, in addition to being there for all the mixing, certainly all the recording, because I'm on the album. Also, I designed the CD booklet, the whole packaging. So it was just every teeny little drop of creativity and skill that I have, I sort of poured into this CD over the past 6 months, and I cannot be more proud of it. I'm really proud of it, and we sound good, it looks good, so we're very, very happy with it.
Is it did it evolve from the Vineyard production to the studio? Did you make any substantial changes to it? I know that there's always little cuts here and there that you make.
Yeah, a little bit. We did tweak a few things. There were at the Vineyard, there were some sort of site specific references where we actually sang some lyrics about the Vineyard, and sang some jokes about, you know, Union Square that were very specific to the audience at the Vineyard, and we sort of tweaked to those because they would make zero sense to a listener, you know, who was listening in Nebraska. So a few little things like that, but not anything major. I mean, the you know, 98% of it is intact from what was performed at the Vineyard. That being said, some instrumentation was added. We did a couple overdubs of some new instrument tracks because we only had four musicians live and four musicians in the studio. So we did a couple overdubs of some extra keyboards and things like that to just sort of round out the sound, which was great.
Tell me about, you know, as you pointed out earlier, we haven't worked together in 20 some odd years. And when we did, you were a full on actor. How did you make the transition into writing and now producing and package design for CDs and things like this? Is, I mean, it's quite a renaissance man that you are.
Yeah, I realized when I was in high school and in college, I really just had an interest in theater and everything attached to it, period. It wasn't, I did like performing and I liked singing, but I also liked being backstage. I liked directing. I liked designing the sets. Like, I just had an interest in all of it. And so when I got to New York, I acted for about 3 years professionally, and it just wasn't really enough for me. I would go do these shows and it was fun, but I was sort of like, huh? Like, this is it? You just go do the show? I kind of had more interest in other things. So I went into talent management for a couple years, and through that I met Susan Blackwell, who's one of my collaborators, and she and I started working on some projects together. I dabbled in some composition, so I started writing some music for her husband, and, you know, in a roundabout way, I became a composer, became a lyricist. I picked up graphic skills as for a day job. You know, I was basically doing marketing and advertising, and then I ran my own marketing company for a few years, and I had to pick up Photoshop and those sort of skills. So just, you know, being on the planet this long has exposed me to things that, you know, has just sort of added to a skill list. But really, it's just the only reason I can do it all is because of time.
So it's fair to say that you're an overnight sensation that took 20 years to make?
Exactly, like everyone else.
Excellent.
I put in my 50 million hours of stuff.
Did you pay your dues time after time?
Yeah, a little bit.
All righty. So tell us about... you know, what's next now? I read on the internets, on those massive tubes that bring us information, that you are working on a pilot?
We worked on a pilot with ABC, Andrew Bell and I, and Michael Barres, who is our director, who also wrote with us. We developed a project for a couple years with ABC that I guess is sitting on a shelf somewhere in Los Angeles, as they all do. Those projects. We learned a lot and had a nice adventure, but we finished that about a year ago. And next up on our project list is title of show is going to London. So That's happening in 2013, and we're getting more information on that right away. But that is a strange thing that's coming up. It's very exciting. We're actually going to put on those costumes and go do that show in the West End.
Well, you're going to be off on, be out of the country in a few weeks. Is this for vacation, or are you going over to prep for title of show?
Yeah, so to go overseas to get the machine going over there.
Excellent. Do you guys have any dates yet?
We have rough dates, so I don't want to say them.
Okay,
and get people
yeah, sure. Well, that's
so. I'm not going to say them.
Well, good for you.
But it'll be in 2013. So get your flights ready.
Well,
you
I
know that the Now Hear This album is terrific. I was listening to it yesterday. So congratulations.
Thank you, Michael.
But also, I know, of course, I re-listened to Title of Show for the first time in a while. And you know what I have to say is it's so incredibly great because it holds up to, you know, it really holds up to repeated listenings, which usually, you know, essentially comic songs don't always do that. So I think that's really a great tribute to you guys. I mean, I was listening to Title of Show, and I just was literally laughing out loud in my apartment. It's so sweet and so funny and so intelligent. It really is just a great, great achievement.
Thank you. Yeah, we enjoy. We actually, about a week ago, we all got together and we had to sign a lot. We had to autograph a lot of the Now Hear This CDs and then some Title of Show CDs as well. And while we're all in the meeting, we decided to put the cast out of a Title Show on after we had listened to Now Hear This. And it was very funny because we haven't listened to it in years and we have to go into rehearsal soon for it. And we were trying to sing along to it and we were just laughing at some of us couldn't remember our parts and how enjoyable. And we were like, oh yeah, this is kind of fun. I enjoyed it. It was such a fun score to sing. And, it was great. So that was fun to sort of tip our toes back into what people tell us is an amazing road trip CD. People love listening to it on their road trips.
Oh, wait, except I think I would be laughing so hard. I'd be afraid I'd have an accident. But it's so great, and really anyone who enjoys that I think will feel the same about Now Hear This, because it's very much the same kind of really smart, sweet, intelligent, funny humor. You know, it's they're both really terrific.
Thanks.
Tell us about the recording process what's it like to work with Kurt? I mean, Kurt is, you know, he's become so important in the industry to bring CDs to market. And for me at least, he's a very different type of record label guy.
Yeah, I mean, it's great working with Kurt. He's very honest. He cuts right to the chase, which helps. Speed up time. He's really great at appearing when you need him and having something to say about it, and then completely disappearing when you have to do your work. And that's a great thing. He has an ability to let the artists do their thing and come in and have something to say about it. But he's only ever helpful and never intrusive and never demanding or any, he's really great and he's very super supportive and he is a complete yes man. I mean, if you're like we're gonna dip all the CDs in gold, he'd be like, yes, do that. Like, he just is so encouraging. So, and he believes anything can happen, and that's a great kind of person to have in a room. And it happens. He makes things happen, which is, you know, to say it and do it are two different things, and he pulls it off.
Yeah, it's great. So what was the, how long did the whole process take from recording to mixing to packaging to getting it out? I know that the prep beforehand takes years, but what did it take you guys to do?
Yeah, we actually did a little bit, even though we're not supposed to. We had to do a little bit of rehearsal because we did the show in the spring, but it took the summer to get the Kickstarter campaign going, which ran through all of August. And then the recording date was set for mid-September. And in that time, we had been out of performance for a long time. It had been over three months that we'd been out of performance, so we had to sort of get our chops back on and learn some of the new lyrics, some of the new music that was going in. The band, we had to take the band and just do a little refresher with them so they wouldn't be, you know, there wouldn't be paper flying in the middle of the recording session. You know, because those, you know, every minute costs $5,000 in a recording session. So yeah. you have to take complete control of every second of the day, which is another thing Kurt's very good at. So there was that. There was that prep. We recorded September 17th, I believe, is when we recorded. And from then, we immediately go in. Joel Moss, who recorded the show, he and I went upstate and worked. We lived in a house in the woods for a week and just lived inside of the CD for a week of just mixing and getting it clear and all of that stuff, which takes quite a while. We went back and forth on that, and you know, you go through one level of approval, then you go through another level of approval where, you know, we're sending this out to Larry Presgrove, our musical director, and Rob Cruz, our orchestrator, Michael Barras, the director, like they're all, Susan and Hunter, the book writer. So there's material going to them for approval and checking in. And, you have that back and forth happening. And then meantime, I'm also designing, because I was designing the booklet, I'm going back and forth with the printers, with the, you know, that sort of, that whole world to get the proofs approved. And so there's a lot going on and it takes a lot of time, but people get their job done and they do it. And I find the deadlines help. If people know, you know, X date is when this is due, they pretty much get on it. And but it was a very long process of a lot of hard work.
Going back to the beginning of the Now Hear This, and in fact, title of show as well. How do you work? Do you write lyrics first, then music, or music then lyrics? How does it organically happen for you?
Kind of organically, it comes out of the mostly what I do is as a composer or as a lyricist. It's all character driven. So if the character's mood informs a kind of musical style, I might start with the style first. If the character's words or their dialogue or their situation it informs a joke or some sort of snappy dialogue, then I might start with the lyric. The lyrics might come out of it first. But more than anything, it's sort of wherever the character's coming from is sort of what influences the music and the lyrics. And it's I very rarely am like, I wrote a song. See if you can make it fit. Like, you know, it's usually based on something that's already there, either in the story or the situation that informs whatever comes out of it. Now, the style might have zero to do with the situation, but we try anything. But so it's all sort of character and situation driven. I think that's what most musical theater writing is. Not really. I don't. Even though I write songs, I wouldn't call myself a songwriter because I don't know that I can be like, hey, Taylor Swift, here's a song called, you know, The Sun's Coming Out Thursday, and just write it. Like I don't know that I would know how to do that. But if Taylor told me she got a new car, I could write a whole song about her new car and how much she loves it.
You know what I'd love to ask you, Jeff? I'd love to ask you where you think musical theater stands in the cultural zeitgeist at the moment, because I guess I kind of feel like it keeps going back and forth, although that may just be my perception. I think it's more central now than it was a few years ago, thanks to things like Glee and Smash and of course, the film of Chicago was a tremendous help, you know. But then there were some other movie musicals that didn't do as well at all. And now Les Mis, you know, seems to definitely have musical theater back in the center of the dialogue. But I was wondering, in general, how you felt about that.
Well, I think like anything, I think if there's a dialogue and exposure to something being real, no matter what it is, then there's an awareness. And I think as long as there's an awareness, that means it's a real thing. Mm. And, you know, for me, in 1985 or 86, you know, living in a small town in Florida, long before the internet and, you know, my television to pick up three channels, I mean, I really only had the Tony Awards, and I don't know why I liked it, you know, and I got, you know, the Mystery of Edwin Drood original cast album or something, and but there was, that was it. I mean, I just was sort of locked in my own chamber of this art form, and I had to go out into the world and go into college and sort of discover it. And now it's just everywhere. Like you can, you know, it's everywhere. And I think that exposure sort of makes musical theater real. It's not a joke. You might not like it. It might not be your taste, but it's something that's very real. And I always think, like, it's so funny because of this shows like Smash and Glee and you know, and Chicago, and there's so many young people have exposure to that sort of now. It amazes me how many just shiny, amazingly talented, fierce kids get off the bus every year and arrive in New York. I mean, I can't believe it. I just think it's like, is everybody majoring in performance at college? Like, there were four of us when I went to college, and now it seems like it's half the school wants to go into show business. So, there, you know, this, that. So I think with that come a lot of voices, come a lot of artists, come a lot of people who have something to say about something. And so that will make more shows and make more people be entertained by things. And so... I think there's that. I mean, there'll always be your lowbrow and there'll always be highbrow.
Right.
And I think you need them both. You know, I need them both. I get bored with one or the other. So,
this week the Wall Street Journal had a feature piece on musical theater schools, which I'm stunned that the Wall Street Journal would write something about this. And,
oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, and they wrote about, you know, University of Michigan and Carnegie Mellon, the major two powerhouses of turning out musical theater performers, and 35 Broadway shows have alumni from Michigan and Carnegie Mellon in their shows right now.
Isn't Cincinnati another tremendous
Yeah, CCM
one?
Is a big one.
Yeah.
You know, Florida State. Jeff went to Stetson, right?
Yeah, I went to Stetson.
You went to Stetson.
I didn't even know colleges taught musical theater until I got to college. It's so funny to me, people, to be in high school and be like, I'm going to go to CCM. I'm like, I didn't know what that was, where that was, what those acronyms, none of that meant. I was like, oh, I got to college. And, oh, you guys teach theater here? Cool. I'll do that.
Well, one of the striking things is that you know, Wall Street Journal did the slant on the return on investment, and you know, I guess it was University of Michigan out of state tuition versus Carnegie Mellon. You know, talking about $50,000 a year for an undergraduate degree in musical theater. It's $200,000 to come out and, you know, start working on an off-Broadway show for $327 a week. You know, it's hard to pay those bills off. But I tell you, it's just like Jeff said, it seems like more and more students are going into formalized programs like that.
Well, Jeff, did you get to see the PBS special on the Jimmy Awards? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Well, I was there live and in person, and it was the best night of my life last year.
Right. I'm sorry. Yeah. Of course. I forgot. I'm sorry.
You're not supposed to know that. I thought I was secretly hiding. Hunter and I had a blast. I was the most amazing thing ever.
Yeah. Isn't it? Yeah.
But I have not seen the documentary yet, but Hunter has it TiVo'd for me.
Oh, you must see it. It's so well done. And then there was also, are you aware, there's a film called Most Valuable Player, a documentary about high school musical theater. And between the two of them, it just really very, very encouraging. Especially the most encouraging thing about it is that these schools are doing, you know, every possible type of musical you could imagine.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
great.
from again, the lowbrow to the highbrow to the middlebrow. And we, you know, there may be individual shows that of course that we all like or don't like, but the point is that there's such a variety of them, and I think that can only be healthy.
Yeah, it's great. And we just found out there's a in Centerville, Ohio, there's a high school, I think it's Centerville High School, maybe. Their production of Tideless Show that they did last year was one of the shows that just got picked for the main stage shows for the International Thespian Conference that's in Nebraska in the summer. Uh-oh. And we're totally going to go and just completely stalk it and be there and support it. And
stalk it?
Yeah, so it's great. I mean, and yeah, and it's the doing that and My Fair Lady, you know, just like the shows that can be on the bill together or whatever are really great. And yeah, it's a, we're very involved in high school theater, and because that's where we fell in love with it, you know. And I love being around high school kids, and I love watching high school kids perform. Our Larry Pressgrove, who is our musical director, he works at LaGuardia High School in New York City.
Oh,
and we go see all the musicals they do there.
I hear they just did an amazing Sweet Charity.
Yeah, the Sweet Charity. Honestly, the theater there, it's the best theater in New York. It's completely, I'm a complete mess when I go see shows there, because they love it so much. They don't know any tricks yet. They're just doing it honestly, open. They're so raw.
Right.
They're so excited. The stakes are so high for them. It's like, it's the most exciting theater that you can see in New York. So anytime anyone can get a ticket to LaGuardia High School production of a musical, go see it, because it's so much fun.
I totally agree. Several years ago, I saw a production of West Side Story there, and you can imagine in that case that, you know, how even much more amazing it was, that because, you know, they were playing kids their own age. And, and I'll never forget, they did something very interesting in that production. They had both of the gangs were very racially mixed, you know, which of course is not what originally was intended, but the point was to make the point that it's not about, you know, people can hate each other for whatever reason, you know.
And it was
very, very moving and very effective.
So, Jeff, before we let you run, I meant to ask you before about the London production. Who's producing? Are you bringing any of the American producers, or is it a new producing team over there?
That's a new producing team over there. Oliver Southgate is one of the lead producer on it, and then he has a group of people, I think, working with him on it. It's all British run.
So do you think it's going to... you're going to reinvent little bits and pieces of it, or is it?
I think we have to a little bit. I think it's a limited engagement, so it's not. It's not a giant thing, but it's. Yeah, we have to. We'll have to tweak a few things that just won't make any. I mean, there'll be. It's one thing to be nine people's favorite thing, as the show preaches, but it's another thing to be, you know, 0.5 people's favorite thing. Like, it does have to make some sort of sense to somebody there and not just us. So there are some things that they have no idea even what we're going to be, what we're talking about at all. So we'll have to adjust some of those things. But for the most part, it's still, it is about four people on a journey in New York City with their friends, working on a piece that goes from inception to opening night. So it's, they like that story. They want us to do that story there. So it's great. So we're very excited about it.
Great. For everybody out there listening, Now Hear This is available at chickaboom.com. Please check it out there. You can order it there for $14.99, or you can get it on iTunes for $11.99. But get the CD, because it's nice to have the CD and the packaging and the liner notes, and Jeff worked on them himself. Head over to Chickaboom. We have a link to it in our show notes, and you can see a video there as well. And pick up the CD, listen to a few tracks. Jeff, thank you so much for joining us on a Sunday morning. And please, when you're over in London, we'll Skype and we'll get your take on what's happening over there, okay?
Absolutely. Thanks, James. Thanks, Michael.
Yes.
All right. Have a great day.
Have a happy holiday.
You too.
You too.
Okay,
all right.
Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.
When he least expects it, he suddenly finds himself metabolizing from the heat.
And then to his surprise, he suddenly multiplies. And every millisecond he celebrates a new birth. And soon he makes his way through all of the ocean.
part of every plant and dinosaur on the earth. Oh, 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 oh. Dinosaur. Oh, that amino acid is the key that will open the door. What are the odds that all this prehistoric fauna gets to have so much fun?
So with the holidays up and about us, Michael has pulled back a little from seeing new shows, but he did see the 70mm Film Festival. What's it up at Lincoln Center, is it? Or is it AFI? Or?
Yeah, no, it's the Film Society of Lincoln Center at the Walter Reed Theater. They're having, right as we speak, it has begun a 70mm film festival. And, you know, for those of you who... have never seen 70mm, and there may be many of you who haven't, it really is an amazing format. Many people feel it's still the most superior film format there is, even better than you know, than current digital projection, which aims to look like that, if they can get it right, I think. And sometimes they do, but sometimes they don't. But anyway, 70mm was very big back in the day, and it's interesting to see the films that actually were made in 70mm, the ones that I think well, generally, the ones that were really event films. And that includes several musicals back in the day when musicals were really, really the big thing, or a big thing, such as The Sound of Music, West Side Story, and My Fair Lady. And all three of them are being shown as part of this festival. Today, I'm going to see a double bill, actually, of Star, which is the film biography, a musical biography of Gertrude Lawrence, starring Julie Andrews, and that was actually quite the flop financially. But it was intended, you know, it was expected to be a huge hit, and it's actually Robert Wise, who directed Julie Andrews in The Sound of Music, directed this one too, and there are a lot of other people involved. From that previous project, and it was another 20th Century Fox release. But it's certainly, even though it's not based on an actual show, it's certainly quite something for theater aficionados because of all the Noel Coward is a character in it because he was very good friends and colleagues with Gertrude Lawrence from an early age, and he's brilliantly played by Daniel Massey, whom many of us know from aside from everything else from She Loves Me, the original cast recording. And there's a lot of Coward songs in it. There's a couple of songs from Lady in the Dark. Although nothing from The King and I, because one of the very odd things about Star is that it only takes up Gertrude Lawrence's life. It only follows it through Lady in the Dark, and it doesn't continue on to her later years, which were very dramatic because she died during, you know, while she was appearing in the original Broadway cast of The King and I as Anna. I don't mean she died on stage, but she became very ill and she died during the run and she had to be replaced. So anyway, that's something to check out if you haven't seen Star. It's really very interesting, if only from a historical aspect. And that's at, well, today, we're speaking here on Sunday morning. It's today at 1. I think that may be the only screening of it, but it is available on DVD and I think maybe Blu-ray also, so check that out. And then The Sound of Music, I have seen it in 70mm, but I'm definitely going back. It's today at 7:45 p.m. and I know there's at least one other showing, I think, on Christmas Day. West Side Story is being shown on Christmas Day and the day after. And My Fair Lady is being shown on Saturday the 29th at 5:45, and I think there's another showing of that as well. Check out the website. It's the Film Society of Lincoln Center, and really, you know, it's so fascinating to see these films that were made at the time when a big budget film musical was a huge event. And it's interesting too, because now, as we know, as we speak, Les Mis is trying to bring that back. And James has said that he's been getting a tremendous amount of feedback about Les Mis and just general interest expressed in it. So I think it might be huge, you know, regardless of whatever the critical reaction is, and it has been mixed. So what do you think, James? Is it going to be huge?
You know, I don't know if I'm living in an echo chamber or not, but it seems like my non-theater friends are talking about going to see it. And the prognosticators who talk about the Academy Awards and the Golden Globes and things like that seem to think that it's going to win a lot of things. Mm. And I mean, Hugh Jackman and Russell Crowe are in it, and it's one of the highest grossing musicals in the world.
Right.
I think it could be huge. It certainly seems as though that the film studios are promoting the heck out of it.
Yeah.
So we'll see. I mean, everybody who has really wanted to go see it that's within the Broadway community has certainly had the opportunities to see many screeners, and there's a tremendous amount of buzz about it. So I don't know if it's the echo chamber or if it's actually going to be really big, but it seems really good. And the trailers look great. And I'm a huge Les Mis fan, and my wife hates Les Mis. So I don't know if on Christmas Day I'll be sitting in a movie theater by myself, or if I'll coax her into coming to it, or if I can bring the kids to a two-hour-plus movie or so, if they'll sit through it. So I don't know. We'll see what happens, but it's going to be very soon. I promised Lucky and the Mick that we would have a Les Mis discussion, so maybe after all of us have seen it sometime in January, we'll all get back and talk about it. And I encourage listeners to, you know, call us up and leave voicemails of what you thought about it, or send us emails about it, and tell us your feelings on it. And, you know, I think we're going to have a nice conversation about it. And there is, I think we talked about it on the podcast a few weeks ago, that this buzz around Les Mis has prompted Cameron McIntosh to talk about a movie of Miss Saigon.
Yes.
So we'll have to see what happens there.
Well, I think your point is well taken about whenever you hear people who are not necessarily musical theater fans say they really want to see something, that's almost always a sign that it's going to be huge. I remember, just to name a few examples, it happened with The Producers. I definitely remember hearing that from several people. It happened with Spider-Man.
Book of Mormon, yeah.
But yes, that was the third one I was going to name. So that's always a tremendously good sign, as far as I'm concerned, that something's going to really do very well.
Yeah, so we'll have to see. I mean, we're, I guess, only 2 days away from the official opening of it. So yeah. So we'll, maybe next week we'll talk a little bit about it. We'll see if Lucky and the Mick are around, and we can get them on to talk about it as well, and maybe Jan and a few other folks. I was thinking of, you know, we're going to be bringing over the next couple of weeks, Mark Shenton from London is going to be on, and Richard Azunian from the Toronto Star is going to be on. And we're looking for folks who are not in New York. I mean, Michael's in New York, Peter's in New York, I'm in New York. We're very New York-centric, but, you know, the world of theater happens so many other places. We're trying to reach out to David Ng over at the Los Angeles Times, and a few other folks around the country, Chris Jones in Chicago, to bring people on. So as listeners, if you have a favorite columnist that talks about theater in your hometown, you know, email us and let me know who it is so we can get in touch with them and talk about theater in your town as well, because, you know, we tend to be very New York-centric, and we should be talking about everybody. So, Michael, back in 1962.
Yes.
Back in 1962, there was a television show called Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol, with music by Julie Stein and lyrics by Bob Merrill. It's playing again. So what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I'm so delighted. There seems to be a huge flurry of re-interest in it, and I guess it must be because I had not realized that this is the 50th anniversary. I didn't know exactly when it came out. I knew it was the mid-60s. I thought it was a few years later. I guess I must have first seen it a few years later because I don't think I was 5 when I first saw it, although maybe, who knows. But yes, in December of 1962, and it was the first of what turned out to be a whole series, a flurry of classic animated TV Christmas specials that went on to become beloved classics. But this was the first one, and it was followed by Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, the claymation animation version of it, which so many people love so much, and How the Grinch Stole Christmas, and Charlie Brown Christmas, and then there were a whole bunch of others that I'm not as familiar with. The Little Drummer Boy, there was Frosty the Snowman, but yeah, I guess really most of them from the mid '60s. So I don't know, exactly what I guess Magoo Christmas Carol was a big hit, and then people thought, well, let's do more of them, but they did them so well, and this at a time, of course, when network television was. The audiences for the shows were just beyond huge. We can't even hardly fathom the amounts of people who watched these shows. And, you know, of course, there was no home video, so you watched it, and then that was it, and you waited until the next year. And things became very special, these special events, in the same way that people used to wait all year to see The Wizard of Oz on TV, because you had no other option. In the case of The Wizard of Oz, there might be a very occasional re-release to theaters, but you certainly weren't going to see those Christmas specials in theaters. So and Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol, aside from everything else, it has a score by Julie Stein and Bob Merrill, who went on to write most famously Funny Girl, also Sugar, and a couple of other shows, and then separately they both had amazing musical theater careers with other writers. So that's tremendously significant, and Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol has some wonderful songs, including this just heartbreakingly beautiful ballad called Winter Was Warm that I don't know anyone who knows that song who doesn't just really love it, and it holds a very, very special place in their hearts. It's sung by in this version of this story, the character is called Belle, the young woman whom Scrooge was in love with when he was a young man. But then she leaves him because she sees him changing, into a very greedy, mercenary, kind of all around selfish, horrible individual. And then he's brought back to see her and himself as younger people by the ghost of Christmas past. And he's just filled with remorse at how seeing how much this woman loved him and how he loved her and how wrong he was to just make that terrible life choice. So the setup is amazing. And then the song itself is so beautiful. But anyway, this is the 50th anniversary, and I have the film on DVD. I've had it for a few years, and now I hear it's on Blu-ray. So I urge everyone to get it. It was shown last night, Saturday the 22nd, by NBC for the first time in decades. But I'm very unhappy to report that it was edited so severely that it was kind of just a travesty. So why, I just don't know why they would bother to do that. I don't quite get it. I don't see the point. But as I said, if nothing else, maybe it'll just help to create more interest in it. And you can always get the DVD or the Blu-ray and check it out, because it's really something special, as a relic of the days when a great musical theater team would write a score specifically for television, you know, as Rodgers and Hammerstein did with Cinderella and several other examples. I believe Cole Porter wrote a TV musical. It's do you know the show, James?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it was very popular in its day, and then apparently it was shown for several years thereafter annually, but then something happened and it went into syndication and it wasn't shown as much, and then it stopped being shown at all. And there was also a little bit of an issue with it, because Mr. Magoo, for those of you who don't know, was a character who the source of the humor was that he was tremendously nearsighted and kept like bumping into things and like mistaking, you know, sacks of potatoes for people and things like that. And I guess that, you know, that became politically incorrect quite some time ago to make fun of someone for not being able to see, which, and you know, I think we can all understand why it became politically incorrect. But, you know, it was from a simpler time when people weren't that sensitive to those things. The framing device in Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol is that Mr. Magoo himself is starring in a Broadway musical based on A Christmas Carol. So the nearsighted jokes only happen at the very beginning of the show. And then I think maybe there's one at the very end. But in the middle is a very straightforward retelling of A Christmas Carol. Very, very effectively done. Oh, Jack Cassidy sings and speaks the role of Bob Cratchit. And he has a great song, one great song in particular called The Lord's Bright Blessings that he sings with his family. And then he has also a duet that he sings with Scrooge in the beginning, when Scrooge is cackling while counting his money, penny by penny. And Cratchit is in the other room shivering because it's so cold in their counting house, because Scrooge won't let him even start a decent fire in the stove. Jack Cassidy, Jane Keen is another of the voices, Maury Amsterdam. It's really quite a wonderful little film that everyone, I think, should try to catch up with.
Absolutely. And I guess it's available on Amazon.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Things like
that. I didn't know it was on Blu-ray, but several people have said it. So I guess it must be true. I do not have a Blu-ray player, but I really I'm a little behind the technological times lately. But that would be something, because I should say the animation itself is quite crude in terms of, you know, the motions of the characters, but you know, it's simple and it fits the story, and also the colors are quite something. This was, again, was 1962, which was very early for color TV. I don't think the big push in color TVs came for another couple of years yet. It was around 1964, 65, if I recall, when there was a really huge push, and a lot of the shows, the sitcoms, et cetera, that were being presented in black and white, they suddenly made the shift over to color. Many shows, Bewitched, Lost in Space, I could go on and on. This was also innovative in being done in very vibrant full color, and I think that that's another reason it really stands up, and it's really become a wonderful classic.
Yeah, if you are an Amazon Prime member, you can watch it instantly. So if you get over to Amazon, you can click on it and watch it right away. You don't even have to wait for the DVD to be delivered to you. So, moving forward, our follow-up to our discussion with Maureen McGovern, Michael got to see her at 54 Below. Why don't you tell us quickly what you thought?
Oh, it was just a fantastic show. I went to the opening, and she looks and sounds absolutely fantastic. And I was so happy because, as we discussed when she was our guest, she has a beautiful, beautiful Christmas album released several years ago, and now out of print, but she did almost all of it. in her show at 54 Below, or a very large portion of it anyway, in addition to some other things. She managed to work the morning after into the show in a very very moving and effective way. It didn't seem shoehorned in at all. And although she'd made no direct reference to any of the recent tragedies, whether Hurricane Sandy or the Newtown shootings, I think that was that subtext was very clear, and the morning after was very effective in that context. But the Christmas songs were just wonderful, and she even had Jay Lenhart with her, the great bassist and vocalist, who is on the recording as well, and they recreated their magnificent version of Santa Claus is Coming to Town, which is the joke is basically that Santa's flying in and he's just landed at LaGuardia. So
good luck in a taxi.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, why LaGuardia? But Newark is so much easier to get in, I always find, to get into the city from Newark. But anyway, it was a delightful show, and I'm delighted to say that Maureen got at least two rave reviews that I read in the New York Times and the Daily News. So I was very happy to see that, and it was wonderful to see and hear her. I don't think she's performed in the city for a while. If she did, I missed it. But I think it's been a few years. So that was very special.
I'm sorry to say that if you are listening to this, you have missed her, because today is her last performance. And she went from the 18th to the 23rd, and maybe we'll be able to see her in different venues sometime soon. But you've missed her at 54 Below. Not that we haven't warned you enough.
Yes, we warned you 2 weeks ago.
Exactly. And perhaps Santa is flying into LaGuardia because he's trying to visit with the people at Rikers who probably need the most help. So, in the news, let's cover a handful of news things before we run, just very high level and quickly, because none of this is really... needs much discussion, but Phantom of the Opera turns 25. Could you imagine?
Phantom of the Opera turns 25, and also
on Broadway.
And also, Chicago is about to become the third longest running musical in history, in Broadway history. The revival. Isn't that incredible?
Yeah. Next up, we have Jason Robert Brown's The Last 5 Years at Second Stage. I can't say that. Jason Robert Brown's The Last 5 Years at Second Stage. Betsy Wolff and Adam Cantor are going to be starring in it, which is great. I'm really looking forward to seeing that.
I can't wait to see it. I love that piece so much.
One of my favorites.
Yeah, it was the off-Broadway premiere production. Was, despite starring Norbert Leo Butz and Sherry Renee Scott, who were amazing in it, it was not a success, I think, because it's a very difficult show to stage because of the concept of it, and I don't think that production was successful in terms of the staging and the direction. But I have seen it since. Several productions of it. And I think, again, it's one of those cases where simpler is better. And so hopefully they'll follow that template. Jason is directing this one himself.
Yes.
So I think that's actually a very good sign, because I think he agrees with that less is more thing. And Betsy Wolff is a wonderful talent and a beautiful woman. She's currently in Edwin Drood. I've seen her in a few other things, and she's fantastic. And Adam Cantor, if you all don't know him, is also a really great performer. He was the final, I believe, the final Mark Cohen in Rent, the original Broadway production. And he is on the DVD of that, which you've gotta get if you haven't seen it. And it's probably on Blu-ray again also. This was the production that was cinecast in theaters. He's really great, and so the two of them in that show sounds like just a really must see for everybody.
Yeah, I don't know if you knew that I drove out to Chicago to see the first production of Last 5 Years. And so I saw it in Chicago at North Light with Norbert and Lauren Kennedy.
Right.
And then Lauren couldn't come to New York because she was doing Sound of Music or something in London. I can't recall it, but she was doing something in London. I think it was Sound of Music. And then Sherry came in. I think that the New York production suffered from a marketing problem more than anything else.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
I think that they didn't market the show correctly. And certainly two people in the show and an off-Broadway production, they should have, that thing should have still been running, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But next up is Big Fish is nailed down their dates for their Broadway tryout in Chicago. I'm looking forward to that. I'm dying to see what Susan Stroman is going to do with it. She's directing and choreographing it because I am a fan of the movie. I can't envision it in my head as a musical, but we'll see. And I mean, I have a tremendous amount of faith in Susan Stroman, and the underlying work is very good.
I don't know that movie, but that's so I can't address it. But that sounds like a really interesting project.
Yeah. Michael, are you sitting down?
Yes.
Good. I just want you to know that Glengarry Glen Ross recouped their investment, which is not a shock to anybody, given the powerhouse of the stars that were involved. And I wonder, I wish Peter were here. We'll have to ask him next week or the week after, what is the record for recoupment number of days after their official Broadway opening? Because
well, and also, does it count if the opening was delayed by a month? You know?
Yeah, I mean, they've been running for a number of weeks.
But really, that is quite an achievement for them when you think about it. Because I mean, I don't know exactly what Al Pacino's salary is, but I assume it must be quite high. And so, to recoup under those circumstances, you know. Is even more of an achievement for, you know, and for a straight play to recoup. That's fantastic.
Is it scary that other producers are going to look at this and say this is the new formula to make money?
Well, do you mean to have a big star?
Well, you mean you know, limited run. I guess they did it in Death of a Salesman as well, bringing Philip Seymour Hoffman in, limited run and expensive tickets, and they just get in, they get out. And
well, it does seem like for quite a few years now that that has become more of the usual
place
that any play, yes, usually has a big star in it and is a limited run.
Was it Gandolfini in Art? Was Gandolfini in Art, or was he in something else?
Gandolfini was in
The Two Couples. I'm blank on it.
It's I'm sorry. It's because the title has nothing to do with the play. Oh, for God's sake.
We'll think about it in a second. But you know what else recouped?
What?
It's Newsies.
Yes, Newsies. Yes, I was going to say there was another one. Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, Newsies with no stars in it and a big cast and a big production and started out as a limited run. Has recouped, so we have a lot of holiday cheer on Broadway for certain folks.
So, the God of Carnage.
God of Carnage. That's
yes. Right. I'm sorry, I could never remember that.
No, me too. I'm, you know, Art. Who was in Art? Was it?
Art was, well, originally it was, wasn't it Alan Alda? And oh,
let's
boy.
Let's see.
Maybe we should cut all this out, James. We're making ourselves sound like fools. I'm just kidding.
Okay. I mean, you know, people make these mistakes all the time. Alan Alda, Victor Garber, Alfred Molina.
Yes. Okay, good. I got it right.
You did. See, I'm the fool and you're not.
No.
And then this talk that Judd Apatow from Hollywood is writing a Broadway play.
Oh, right.
We'll have to see what happens there. Robert Sean Leonard and Charlotte Parry are going to star in the Old Globes Pygmalion. So I wonder if that will come to New York. Robert Sean Leonard's such a great actor, and Charlotte Parry, it's going to be a great That's a great teaming there.
Oh, I hadn't read that. That's really interesting.
Yeah. And then, as if there weren't enough Christmas miracles, did you see this morning's New York Post?
No.
Michael Riedel did an interview with he didn't write his gossip column. He did an interview with Hugh Jackman, like a Q&A. Like, it's so out of place for Michael Riedel, but it was a nice Q&A. So,
wow.
Yeah, so, you know, all that stuff's in the show notes. And that's about it. So, Michael, anything you want to say before we go?
Not much. I hope everyone has a wonderful holiday season. It has been a bad year for many people in many ways. But, you know, hopefully things are looking up. Although I did realize something. Am I the first one to realize this? We have 2013 coming up. And I think, you know, I'm certainly not.
I think other people realize that.
I'm not. No, but what I meant was. What I meant was, I myself am not subject to triskaidekaphobia. But I believe this will be the only year, ending in 13, that most of us will live through. I mean, I don't believe that. I know that. So I hope. That there isn't anything in that, and I personally, again, don't think that there is, but gosh, you know, 2013.
I'm more afraid of spiders than numbers. So I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com, and there's a subscribe button. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. You can also listen to us on the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your Android device, or your BlackBerry. You can listen to us on the fly and streaming, so you don't have to synchronize. Also, our contact information, Twitter, Facebook, phone numbers, ways to get in touch with Michael, Peter, and me are all there. I forgot to mention, we are on Broadway World Radio, Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. So if you miss us in the other ways, you can also listen to us there. So on behalf of Peter Felicia, who's out with his family this week, and Michael Portantier, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Merry Christmas. Bye-bye.
Merry Christmas.